Oh, hello. Greetings, Reclaimers. I am 343 Guilty Spark, monitor of Podcast Evolved. Protocol dictates that you must listen. Come, we have a wealth of knowledge to share with you, and you don't want to make my blue eye red. Do you, Reclaimers?
Welcome, Spartans, to another Halo Book Club episode, a part of Podcast Evolved, your home for Halo. I'm your host today, David, and joining me is Krista.
Hi.
Aaron.
Hi, guys.
And Oren.
What's up, everyone?
I'm going to be reading the sex scene live on the air. Are you guys ready?
No, that's a different Patreon tier. That's a special one, Krista.
Oh, oops, sorry.
We're keeping that behind a big-ass paywall.
You're going to have to be the Didact himself to listen to that.
What actually happens is, if you don't give us money, I'm going to read the sex thing.
So this is the first for us where we're actually going to go back and re-record a book club.
What?
Yeah, I know, it's weird. It's multiple reasons for this. It's our oldest one, and we've completely kind of changed the way we kind of do things. Obviously, we're way more professional now. We know exactly what we're doing.
I have bad news for you.
Don't we? We're so professional. But also, we got new people on the show since then. So the original recording was the 29th of September 2014, which is a shit-ass long time ago when I looked it up today.
It also, like, wasn't a separate episode?
No, yeah, we had a different style of doing it back then. We kind of mashed them all together into our episode, so it was way longer. It wasn't all about the book club. So breaking out the book clubs into their own episodes happened sometime after that. Today, we're going to record, obviously, Aaron and Oren's opinions on this book have never been recorded ever. And Oren, in fact, is his first time reading the book, so it's kind of interesting, given the fact that it's one of the old guard kind of books written in Bungie's time. Yeah, I'm really interested to just kind of get you guys talking and see what you guys think, and also have myself and Krista's opinion on it changed. Probably not.
Yeah.
We are doing Halo Contact Harvest, which is a unique book in that it is the first contact essentially between humans and the Covenant, and how that kind of went about and some of the events surrounding it. It's pretty cool.
It ends poorly, spoilers.
I think we all know how it ends. First contact does not go well, but it's really cool to see things introduced and what other events we actually get as part of this book.
This is the only piece of media, this was the first piece of media that, like, answered the question, why does the Covenant want to kill us?
Yeah, it really did, yeah. It gave us the exact reason why humanity is being treated so differently than other alien races the Covenant have encountered up to now. And it's a pretty, it's fascinating, it's pretty cool. So we'll get into that a little bit. I'll do some of the social stuffs. Guys, if you haven't already, or maybe you're due to go back and take a look, go check out our website. It's halopodcastevolve.com or halopodcast.com. It's got pretty much everything. It's got all our shows. Obviously, our feeds have a limit. So some of our older stuff is pretty much only kept on our website. You can get our weekly show, Podcast Evolved, that kind of tells you about lore discussions and Halo news and stuff like that, and general chit-chats amongst the crew. We have Mission Debrief, which is a deep dive into every Halo Games campaign, mission by mission. We also have our newest show, which is Built with Blocks, and that is centered around the micro action figures, as you can guess, with the brick-based construction sets of the Halo universe. We also have a Patreon page, so that's patreon.com/HaloPodcastEvolved. Pretty much, as we have a whole variety of exclusive rewards for our patrons, like early episodes, swag, all that kind of stuff. So please go check us out if you think to drop us a few dollars bills. That'd be great. Thank you very much. We would also like to take this moment to thank all of our current patrons for their continued support. You guys are amazing. Like, we are on a total upswing.
Yes, thank you so much.
Really impressive. We have to keep coming up with new shit to do because we're like, what do we do now? We're not supposed to be at this level right now, but we are.
This was never supposed to happen.
No, this is not supposed to happen this way. But it's awesome. And it's great to see that we have the ability to do things like that and keep ourselves going and keep giving you guys new things. And it's just a never-ending cycle. Finally, I would like to encourage our listeners who want more to listen to, you can support us on Audible. So listen to a growing collection of Halo novels all in one place, along with thousands of other novels, podcasts, guided wellness programs, Audible originals, and more. So if you fancy giving us a little bit of support over there, you can use the URL audibletrial.com/podcastevolved, and then you'll learn more and start your free trial on Audible. So that's where some of the guys I know listen to it, like the audiobooks and stuff like that. So I think Aaron and Oren, you both listen to the audio versions. So they'll be giving us a little more info on that. There are audio peoples. Krista and I are real book peoples. I sometimes do fake books.
There's something other than real book?
Not really, Krista.
Yeah, there's
not
digital really. Books.
What? Blasphemy. What do you put on your shelf?
Laundry.
You put laundry on your bookshelf?
You just said shelf.
How are you supposed to always have an existential crisis of you obtaining more and more stuff if you're not buying books?
But Krista, I have that because I have the books and I have the digital books and I have the audiobooks. A real dedicated fan would have them all.
No, that's the best way to do it.
See, 30 plus novels take up a lot of space, or they could take up a fair amount of data.
Yeah, you can't store your novels in the cloud.
I don't know. They look... Let me just tell you, lining up the Halo novels on a shelf is gorgeous. They look so nice. They look amazing. And then when people come into your house, they're like, oh, Jesus Christ, who are you? And I'm like, I'm crazy. Hi.
You're like, this is who I am. What were you saying there, Aaron?
The paperbacks keep changing size. It drives
they
me
do.
Mad.
I go for a mix, too. It depends on the community. More often than not, because my Halo books are in my parents' house in my old room on a shelf, like a correct person. But more often than not, I'm like, I forget to go home and get the book. So I'm like, oh shit, I gotta start reading this book this week. So I end up going on and buying it on my Kindle and reading it on my phone. And that kind of happens a lot. So I read all of Contact Harvest, I'd say about 50% of it on my phone and the rest of it on my Kindle.
Every once in a while, Amazon like has a special thing where it's like, oh, buy the book. And then guess what? For $2 more, you can get the digital version. I always do that. Every single time I'll do that.
Does it give you both?
Yeah, so you get the physical version and you pay a little extra, and then you get the... Well, you get the physical, you pay a little extra, and then you get the digital.
Well, I've never noticed them bundled like that.
It depends on the book, but every once in a while, Amazon like pops up and says, get the digital version.
I have seen it here for... They do it with, if you buy the audiobook version, they sell you the ebook, because then...
Because the audiobooks are so expensive, though.
Yeah, but you get those with the like monthly subscription, so it's not as bad. But when you combine them, you can sort of like flick back and forth. So if you read a bit on your Kindle, the audiobook will update to where you are.
Oh, yeah, that's really clever, yeah. I think that's their whisper sync or something, is it? Is
yeah, you can get them to sync together.
That's kind of amazing.
And that's on Kindle?
It's an Amazon thing, yeah.
That's interesting because you might hear something. You might be like listening to it and you might hear something and be like, oh, did I mishear that? And then you can easily pull up the book and just take a quick gander at what you just heard.
If you only listen to the audiobook, you would call it trebuchet and not trebuchet.
Yeah.
Trebuchet.
That's one of the audiobooks with mispronunciations.
That's essentially like when I'm listening to the audiobook, if I have the time to follow along with the digital book, I will do that. So that's what I did with Contact Harvest. Otherwise, if I'm like working and stuff, then I'll listen to the audiobook on my commutes and stuff. But most of the time when I'm listening to the audiobook, I'm following along on like on my iTunes or iBooks app on my iPhone. So if Amazon and Audible and all that have these features that kind of integrate all that into one experience, then I may need to look into that a little further, because I kind of do that right now, but I kind of go through some loopholes to kind of do that.
You're also reading it to, like, double speed, so are you, like, just, like, pressing the next book button, like, constantly?
Like, on my phone, yeah, I mean, I go through a page on my phone, like, I don't know, in 20 seconds. I mean, there's over, like, 1,000 pages, because it's in on your phone. Otherwise, like, if I'm... I can't really listen to it at times 2 speed and just like stare at a wall or do something. I can do it at like 1.5 and like, I don't know, do the dishes or do the laundry. But when I'm at times 2 speed and I follow it along, like I just retain it much more clearly.
Now we're going to be testing your memory retention very shortly, Oren.
Uh-oh.
There you go. There's some bonus information on how we read books, guys. Because I know you wanted to know that. Talking about books, here's some book info on this bad boy. The title is Halo Contact Harvest. No surprise there. The author is Joseph Staten. This is a name you should probably know. This fellow worked at Bungie. He was a writer amongst other things at 3-4. At Bungie. Yeah, and he moved with Bungie to do Destiny. And came back to Bungie, or 343, to do other things. I think he was doing some more writing as well.
I thought he left to just join Microsoft as a whole.
You could be true. That's could be where I get mixed up.
Because he also wrote the game ReCore.
That's right. He did, yeah. So he came back to Microsoft Games Studios probably to do other bits and pieces. Not just Halo stuff. But this is his first book. He's done one or two others. I think he did a short story. He is a lovely fellow. He is a massive lover of Ungai and the Grunts. And he voices a lot of them in the games. He does a lot of the original voice work for the Grunts. And he writes excellent characters and really good alien characters. And we see a lot of them in this book. And I think fair play to him, because obviously, as a first, you know, it's your first book. That's got to be tough enough and nervous. And some of the trivia I saw is that he actually helped Eric Nyland actually helped him write the first chapter and stuff like that to kind of get him started. And he obviously had the Halo Bible and the team around him to help him. Frank O'Connor did a lot of kind of editing and stuff like that as well in terms of proofreading the book, and they were really, really self-conscious of canon. And I think this is obviously post Halo Reach, the book, but before the game. But they were really self-conscious of what they were creating and when they were creating it. So I thought that was kind of cool that actually calls it. And there's different interviews and stuff like that I read. Some bonus info if you're interested, go check it out. The publisher is Tor Books. It has been reprinted in 2019 by Gallery Books. I think a lot of the Halo books did a reprint in the last year or two via Gallery Books and stuff like that. The formats are all, as you pretty much heard us all discuss, every possible type of format that you could possibly read for this book. The release date, the original release date, is the 30th of October 2007. So it came out just about a month after Halo 3, which is an important piece of information just to be aware of like the time of when this book was being written. It also came out April 9th, 2019. That's the obviously last year's edition with Gallery. The length is 400 pages in the original, 416 in the 2019 edition. I don't think the 2019 edition has any additional content. It is just possibly just text size that changes the page numbers. As far as I'm aware, there's nothing on Halopedia that says there's any difference.
If you're unfamiliar, the original book is one of those really small, like, old school paperback books where the text reaches almost the bottom of the page.
Yeah.
They probably made it, you know, the normal book size, like we see in all the other Halo books, and then the text was probably a bit bigger.
That makes a bit more sense. I'm going to give you a quick summary if you're not already aware. So this comes straight from Halopedia. Set between 2524 and 2525, Contact Harvest details the first contact between humanity and the Covenant on the outer colony planet of Harvest, as well as the events leading to the beginning of the Human-Covenant War. Staten described the novel as an ensemble piece, as Contact Harvest is narrated from the points of view of both human and Covenant characters. The novel centers around a young UNSC Marine, Staff Sergeant Avery Johnson, a popular and major recurring character that appears throughout the Halo series. Spoilers, he murdered him immediately after this book was written. He was never heard from again. This book was actually originally supposed to come out before Halo 3, which kind of makes a bit more sense because a lot of the stories that start in this book end in Halo 3. So you get kind of the origins of, like, we're going to go in some of the other kind of characters that actually feature in the games. It's kind of interesting to think that they're back. They were giving you some of that backstory before the third game came out. Its timeline, is like we said, it's 2524 and 2525. it's actually near the very end of 2524. I think there's only a few months, the whole book, between the start and end dates, so it doesn't take place over a very long period of time. Events happen, transpire quite quickly. And some of the downtime is actually just like travel time because of, and they actually do a good job in this book of explaining that and kind of how things work, but I don't want to get delved too deeply in there. And the locations, it takes place predominantly on the planet Harvest, as you can imagine, but there's also some bonus content, and I say that in terms of I did not expect to get any of this on High Charity. And it actually has the introduction and origin stories of the three hierarchs that we know throughout the from Halo 2 and 3.
So good.
It's really good origin story. It's fascinating. It opens, it just answers a lot of stuff, and it gets us to see what the inside and the inner politics, but not too deep, of the Covenant and stuff like that. And it's great to kind of see those kind of things and to see some of the things hinted at in terms of their formation and how they kind of came about. There's a lot of interesting characters. I won't name them all because we're going to have a bit of a chat now, a sec, about it. I don't think there's anything else. Yeah, I think I might leave it there. And guys, what do you think of this book? I have to say I really enjoyed it, and I did enjoy reading it again. I don't think I'd read it since a couple of years, I want to say, in between. I remembered some of it, but there's bits that I totally forgot that were in it. A few characters I totally forgot were in it as well. So I'm going to let Krista maybe. Krista, tell me about this book. What do you think?
Do we want Aaron and Oren? Because I have a controversial statement.
Ooh, hot topics coming on. Look at this. Okay, Aaron, you've read this book before.
I have.
Yeah, okay, cool. Leave me off there. What do you think of this book, buddy?
I like this book. It's a good book. I enjoy the build-up of everything. There's something kind of nice about a prequel book where even though you know where it's going, they still manage to tell an interesting story. We know how this ends. We know that there's going to be a Covenant war and humanity's kind of fucked, but we get this build-up. And they throw a few interesting characters in, like you get Jenkins, you get Sergeant Johnson's kind of origins of where he comes from. They do some good AI stuff, which I really enjoy.
Totally, yep, I totally forgotten about the AIs.
Overall, it's funny, I don't want to talk about another book, but reading all of this, and then you think back to Broken Circle, and you can see exactly where he was laying down all the things that he clearly wanted to touch in another novel. His love for this is the Covenant. There's so much time goes into building up the starts of it, and then you get more of it later on. And like, overall, I enjoy this book. There's very little of it I don't like.
I agree with that sentiment about Broken Circle and had the same sort of thoughts when I was reading this. I'm like, oh, I can definitely see how Broken Circle layers on top of what was known and or what was kind of delved into in this novel because it was written so early. And it's interesting that like I reading it now as so late, I think, in kind of the Halo timeline or like the modern Halo sort of universe, it's a strange perspective because it's a lot of the information was more or less already known to me, but it was very much told in this is the history book that you need to read and kind of see how the information is then built upon in other resources from this book. I can definitely see like the roots here and how everything else just kind of layers on top of it over the past couple of years.
That's cool. You enjoyed it, I'd say, Oren, in general, yeah?
Yeah, in a general sense, I really enjoyed it. I wasn't expecting it to jump around as much as it did. I mean, it's a pretty common staple for Halo books that have multiple viewpoints. And I was kind of expecting to see just, you know, the Harvest side doing their thing and then the Space Covenant side doing their thing and kind of just being that kind of black and white comparison between the two. But little did I know that, you know, there's like three different Covenant perspectives. And then there's also this underlying AI storyline that kind of comes in that invites some very interesting AI characteristics.
An AI love story, or
yes, a love story, you might say. But also like an AI duality that's kind of separate from rampancy in a way.
Yeah, I'd also forgotten about this. And I'm not clever enough to understand, but those two characters, it's mental what happens. We'll talk about it in a sec.
Okay, we'll talk if we want to talk about it later. But it kind of, there's a couple notes in Dr. Halsey's journal that kind of alludes to this kind of duality, except it was a triad in Dr. Halsey's journal.
It's interesting to think that they had done this, but that's cool. Yeah, so like there are so many like stories being told. You have Johnson's segment and the characters around him, around the militia. The most of the story is just him training the militia. Then you have the AI story that happens totally separate. Then you have the Covenant story. You have the original kind of, let's say, the Kigyars and Ungai section. Then you have a bunch of brute sections. And then you have all the High Charity drama happening. There is so much going on.
I mean, I'd break it down into, yeah, five stories where you have the Dob as kind of one story. You have the brutes as a second story, which kind of interlate and kind of intersect a little bit. And then you have the High Charity and the Sang Shiyun kind of doing their thing as well.
Chris is going to give us some hotness now in a sec. It's going to set us all fighting each other. But I think it does a relatively good job of weaving those stories together to give you an overall narrative of First Contact. I know if we go back to some of the older books, I do give out when a book jumps too much. I think this book is borderline not jumping too much. And that's probably only because every time it jumps from Johnson, I'm really interested in what I'm reading. And then I go to something else. I'm like, oh, I'm really interested in what I'm reading again. Anyway, Chris, give us some hotness.
I love this book. It's one of my favorites. It really opens the Halo universe, especially if this is one of the first books you're reading, which, I mean, generally, like, this is probably one of the first books you should read if I was to make a list. But I think it's interesting how a book that is kind of marketed and centered around Johnson. Johnson's kind of the least interesting character in the pool of characters that this book covers. Bum, bum, bum! Johnson's the least interesting character!
Krista Brown, you crazy bitch. Why are you dropping these hate bombs over here?
Because you guys told me to.
Well, yeah. I mean, So we started this conversation and it's like, I don't think that he's like his characterization and his story arc is like just uninteresting. I just think something that because so much happens in this book that you don't have like the momentous sort of moment for each character in each storyline to have, like we don't have like a chief rises above the wreckage and saves the day type of a moment in any of the stories within this book. And so they're all kind of their own little short stories in a way, if you want to think about it that way, to where I can kind of see what you're coming from. But I still think that there's plenty that Johnson does to make his story and like who he is interesting. Kind of like this is the earliest that we've ever seen Johnson, like in his whole badassery that we see in the games, and then even in some of the Chief novels with him already like 20 years into fighting this war, or maybe not 20 years, but like a good decade into fighting these Covenant and stuff. Like we love the kind of Johnson that we see then, and this is, like we've said, the kind of origins of his story among other origins. When you kind of look at it from the beginning and the end, like the beginning of the book, he's kind of this broken, you know, all hope is lost, AWOL kind of individual. And then at the end, he's like, we need to kill all these aliens so we can save humanity. And I feel like that's a very distinct kind of character arc, even if on the way it wasn't overly amazing sort of story. But I still feel like with him training the militia and getting to know these, you know, just random people that aren't even military, and for them to lose their homes in like a blink of an eye to then rally up and fight, you know, call the action and fight the cause, I think is very kind of uplifting and interesting as a foundation to then to know where Johnson goes in his military career after that.
Anyone else have a rebuttal?
I like his origin story. I like where he goes. I agree with Oren. I could see his change between the I mean, we start the book off with a very broken Johnson, which is unexpected, but it's a cool intro. And I'll just say that I love the Operation Trebuchet, which is the operation of the UNSC fighting against the insurrection, and how that kind of mounted up. And his description of, like, it really sets a great tone for what a shitty state humanity was right before the Covenant came along. And you never, well, in the games and stuff like that, it's never even discussed in that kind of way. Do you know what I mean? Because the games have always veered away towards the Covenant and alien fighting as opposed to humans fighting humans. But we've talked about it numerous times, numerous shows, how interesting that is. It's a pretty shitty state, but it's an awesome, really heavy moment of Johnson fighting essentially like terrorism, the casualties of that, and essentially he makes a mistake at the start of the book. But I guess I say make a mistake, but like, what am I saying? He didn't shoot a child in order to kill a bomber.
Or it depends on which viewpoint that you look at it from, whether it was a mistake or wasn't.
It's a complicated matter that you probably wouldn't expect to get in a video game book. It's a horrible situation to be in. Bomb goes off, it kills a bunch of Marines, a load of innocent civilians, and obviously one bomber. Johnson is hurt, but his team, he's not a team leader, he's a buddy friend, another sergeant named Byrne, he's a predominant character in this book, is heavily, very badly injured, and this causes a great rift between Avery and Byrne at the start of this book. And I thought their relationship was awesome. I loved how they kind of overcame that by like the first contact situation, which was also awesome. Like, I loved their little arc a little bit. I mean, it wasn't complicated. Do you know what I mean? It was two soldier men, and like how they overcome this. I mean, you've seen it in other media, like something exactly the same. Two soldiers come being at odds over a decision made or not made by another party, you know? And I thought that was really good.
You can also look at when they first like meet each other on Reach, and like Johnson is like, I'm just here to do this thing. You know, it is what it is. I'm trained in militia. At least I'm not fighting insurrection. And then he turns around and there's Byrne, and they immediately get into a rift. Then they start fighting each other. Then their captain leader,
Captain Ponder
comes out and like tells them to break it up. They're like, this ends now. So like, get one more punch in, and they both like smack each other. And then like, that's it. But there's still like some animosity towards each other.
But they're professional enough. That's what I kind of cool to work with each other.
And so they kind of have this respect for each other, but they also kind of despise each other until the first contact happens. And then they do kind of grow on this relationship, put their past behind them, settle their differences. And now, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, sort of a thing.
Yeah. And then you get to the end of the book where like Johnson has come full circle of like, at the beginning, he like didn't really want to be a Marine. It was all about feeling pride for what he was doing. Is he a good soldier? Is he a good man? It was all flashing back to his aunt and what she had said to him in terms of like, I can't remember that there's a phrase in terms of like, be the best you can or be better, or whatever it was. And he never felt that he lived up to that. And it was only at the end of the book where he looks at his militia, what he's trained his soldiers in terms of like the unit that he created, the camaraderie, the fact that he brought them through this traumatic experience and how far they've come, that he's started to feel pride in himself and what he achieved. And we kind of get to the point where like, he bangs a hot chick and he's got all his confidence. He's bringing all his big dick energy into Halo CE. Do you know what I mean? It totally makes sense. And I thought it was awesome. From start to end, you can see that like, it is a pretty good story. Now, I know where Chris is coming from. The other stuff maybe is more interesting, but I still did like it. I thought it was a good arc.
I definitely don't dislike the Sergeant Johnson stuff. It's just that all of the set pieces surrounding Johnson are a bit more grandiose and a bit more interesting than what Sergeant Johnson's doing.
That's true.
He's got a very simple story.
He's just training a bunch of dudes.
Yeah, he's broken, he trains a bunch of dudes, and then he rises to the occasion. That's pretty much his entire arc throughout this book. And then there's, like, the origins of Truth and Regret and Mercy going on, like, right next to his story, and it's just a bit more interesting, those chapters.
Well, I mean, like, something that I definitely did not expect in this book that I'm actually surprised that I didn't expect it was the whole, like, garden peace offering scene.
Oh, that's a great scene.
Where Tartarus and Maccabus kind of enter the garden after first contact, and they try to make peace. You have the governor there, and you have Johnson. And Johnson's basically, like, leading the ceremony, or at least starting it. And kind of, you know, they offer up different gestures, and they introduce each other. And then once things are kind of settled, then Johnson, like, leads them over to the governor. And kind of how that whole scene was orchestrated, I found very intriguing and one of my favorite parts in the book, because it's something that we haven't really seen in another novel before, but it makes sense because we've seen, or at least I've seen in other sci-fi stories, this type of moment where the first thing that comes to mind for me is in Star Trek, there's the First Contact movie where they have like a similar sort of interaction, and then and in Star Trek's sort of sense, it's a little bit more peaceful. But like that type of interaction and doing the challenges within the Halo universe, and you know, with the greed of the Jiril Hanai wanting to actually kind of supervent them to look for these relics, kind of firing of the BR on the human side, just kind of causes this mass confusion. But I don't know, like that moment, like, yeah, was where these storylines interconnect, because you have the brutes there in the Earth thing in space, and then now they've come planet side, and then they have to run and escape before they start raising hell and everything.
Well, and also remember that the brutes are kind of just thrust into this. Like, I'm sure at a normal first contact kind of thing with the Covenant, the brutes wouldn't be anyone's first choice to come down and do something like this. They just happened to be in the area, pretty much.
Well, I'm pretty sure it was the specific minister who sent Jiril Hanai on purpose so it wouldn't be Sangheili.
Well, no, they picked up Dadab, and then Dadab kind of showed him where the planet is.
Yeah, but they had sent this guy, they had gotten the trans, because you remember Dadab turned on the Kigyar luminary and transmitted it back before that ship blew up. So they knew to come and see if there was any survivors. But that minister becomes regret, let's say. But that minister brings it to what will be truth. So that's the Minister for Fortitude. And they have a conversation of what they're going to do. And he says, he said he's sending a ship to it. And he says, oh my, there's a bit of a backlog of like, don't send Sangheili or whatever, because they want all these relics they want to get at before any Sangheili might get at it, because they're still very stoic about what to do with the relics. And the Minister for Fortitude, his job is to essentially administer who gets what relic and what is done with it in terms of like the distribution. So he's very much wants to get there first, and they deliberately send the brutes there, like, because they have a religious zealot on their side. They want this specific ship with that captain sent there because of that. And that sets up a very unique scene, which is probably not typical of a first contact scenario. And it's probably because of the greed that they have, where they're looking for these relics and they think they found an oracle.
It does a good job of setting up for going forward that Truth relies on the brutes, and he has this relationship with them that if he needs shit done that isn't in the best interest of the Covenant but is in his, he will just turn to Tartarus and the brutes. So like from day one, he's had this setup going where he has his own private sort of mercenaries in the Covenant.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting then to think that it took him the length of the war to get them into position that they end up in at the end of Halo 2.
The problem is, like, at the whole Great Schism and stuff like that, is he had to break the Writ of Union, which is the document that, you know, keeps peace between the Sans Shaihum and the Sangheili. So he needed a really good reason to do that, and killing Regret was the perfect reason for him to finally get the brutes to a status where he can pretty much control the Covenant without anyone like second guessing him or questioning him.
Yeah, I mean he had to wait for the opportune moment and kind of use the Flood invasion to opportunistically, you know, launch his attack.
And you can kind of see this in this book, that Truth is just an asshole who wants it all for himself.
Yeah, he has ambition. But I think it's a great origin, and I kind of loved, and I have to think about, like, when this book was written, we didn't know any of this stuff about the Covenant, about, like, their formation, about the Sanhayum, about the Dreadnought, where it came from, High Charity's origin, being half a fucking big lump of planet pulled up with it, like, all that shit's new.
Talk about the Grunt Rebellion.
Yeah.
Like, just kind of getting the Grunts on their side, talking of, and then they even...
And the Hunters.
The Hunters, and like, what is a Hunter? Like, oh yeah, they're just like little worms and they have armor plating, and it really goes into detail of what the Covenant is and how they are formed together.
Yeah, and like you said, that's where some of the stuff, those tangents kind of get picked up a little bit in Broken Circle at an kind of earlier state, but like, that's awesome. That was so good.
This book plants a lot of seeds of information that a lot of other books have kind of picked up and kind of, you know, expanded upon.
Yeah, in a big way. And I think this is the fourth or fifth Halo book, I think, that was written. So like, there wasn't a whole lot before this. And what was before this was all about Reach and John. Do you know what I mean? This is the first one that came out that wasn't Spartan related.
I'm not sure when Cold Protocol came out, but it's you essentially have the main trilogy plus Onyx, and then this and Cold Protocol are like the six. It was like the six Bungie books, and this was definitely like one of the first four.
It's so good. What I will want to say next, we had a good discussion on some of the characters. There's some unique characters in this book that never show up again
because they die.
Yeah, there's some click-clacking going on. But I do want to touch upon some of the interesting ones. I mean, Johnson meets a character named Healy, who is like a Navy kind of officer who's also sent to train the recruits. He shows up a little. He seems more predominant at the start of the book and then immediately fades into the background. And you hear from him. He's like a medic, essentially. He gets called for every now and again. He doesn't do a whole lot else. That's kind of just what he is. But I think he's an interesting setup at the start just to show that how different Avery is and how serious Avery treats his job, as opposed to this guy who's looking like he's looking for a good time, trying to have a party. He talks to people, he's super friendly, he's a jokester. You know, every TV show ever has some kind of military equivalent of this, of the guy who's just a slacker.
Isn't it Healy when like him and Avery first land in Harvest, like his first thing is like, oh, let's go check out this like titty bar over here.
Yeah. And then Johnson's just having fucking none of it. He just takes over the car and just like manually drives them to their base. I think that's interesting just to see where Johnson is as opposed to the more relaxed individual we get in the games. And that's cool. I think you can see some of that arc coming through. I won't talk too much more. Healy's not that interesting really other than that. We've already touched upon Nolan Byrne, and I want to talk about him more because he is the only Irish character canon in Halo. And it's one of the interesting kind of trivia facts. It says Byrne is one of two characters mentioned in the Halo series who is of Irish descent. There's also a Marine who appeared in the non-canon Halo E3 2000 trailer. So I went and watched this trailer, and it's diabolical, and it should not be counted as like a character because it is just like, oh my, it's like if Krista did an Irish, male Irish act, it's just terrible.
Oh god.
Hello, I'm an Irish man. You want some Guinness?
It's just, yeah. And that's one of the original, that trailer is the one where it's like, oh, it's got all the stuff that got cut from Halo CE in it. Like, it's really early stuff. And it has a character, like these Marines have got names and they're called out. I think this guy is like Mac Lee or something like that. Anyway, he's terrible. Byrne is a fantastic character. He's really good with Johnson. I like him as a gruff kind of soldier, and he's really good in with the militia. His training, he's great opposite to have with Johnson. As I said, I like their arc together. They're a little kind of not a bromance, but as they kind of professionally overcome each other, and they're just really good. They're good together. I like this guy. And I kind of was like, where is this guy? Where is this character? Buried in the Halo Waypoint forums, he is officially killed off.
Aww.
So he died on November 17th, 2522 in the Battle of Earth. So he died during the events of Halo 2.
2552?
52.
I was surprised that he survived his engagement with the Brute, because, like, the Brute straight up punches this guy in the face.
That fight is brutal.
Breaks his jaw to where he can't talk.
He gets sticky grenaded, he gets hit with the hammer, he gets thrown and beat up around, choked, stabbed.
He's the luckiest red shirt.
I was waiting for him to, like, die on the evac ship. When they were like, Byrne's just over there hanging out, resting. And I'm like, oh, dude, he's going to fall asleep and not wake up.
He at least had a better time than Dadab.
Yeah.
So that's probably a good way. Well, I do want to talk a bit more about some.
Well, let's finish up kind of the human side of it.
I'll quickly say, Jenkins is not someone I expected. He has a really good arc, and it just adds more misery to that poor fellow's story. Of he begins here and he ends in Halo the Flood, and he does not have a good life. God bless that poor man. But he is cool. I like his setup. Him and he has a buddy. It's like a spotter. He becomes like a sniper of the group, essentially. He's a farmer. He loses his family in the first kind of wave of attacks. He is pretty much broken from that, but he steps up to the plate a good bit and he does really well in the fighting and engagements that happen later. And then we know his story does not end at all in a nice place.
What I also really like about Jenkins is that very few times do I like read these novels or play the games when like characters are like, oh my gosh, they glassed Reach or they glassed Meridian or whatever, you know, they killed this family or whatever. Like, and as like a player, I just kind of consume that. It's just like, all right, yeah, we hate them. They suck. But like in this moment when Jenkins is like, oh, I need to go save my family, guys. Like, I need to leave. And then Johnson's like, no, they're gone. Just kind of the way it was written really sank with me of just like, wow, this guy's world is just completely blown away. And he was no way prepared for what was happening. And I think it just kind of sets a slightly different tone than what at least what I've been used to where he just wasn't expecting any of this. And it's just the absolute worst thing that could happen to him. And then he decides to rise up on the, you know, of the moment and ends up joining the UNSC at the end of the book, where he's just like, you know, my family didn't really want me to join, but now I will join to protect others.
A lot of that as well is Johnson's mentorship of him. Went a long way, I think, to building him where he would take him where he needed to be.
I really felt that. And it is interesting that, like, with each game and book, the Jenkins character gets a little bit more, like, fleshed out. Because, like, in the game, he's kind of a little bit more comedic relief. And he's the eyes that you see the flood. And then when you read the book, the flood, like, you're just like, oh, yeah, he had a pretty terrible, terrible experience. But at least he had some form of redemption at the end. But then after this book, you just feel completely sorry for him, but happy to know that he was able to survive for 20 years to get all the way to 2552.
Captain Ponder, I'll say real quick, is a badass. He is just your standard run-of-the-mill leader of the militia. He's really cool. I think it's really interesting that there's a story that was supposed to be happening in this, and I say supposed to. I'll talk really quick. So these three men, so Captain Ponder, Nolan Byrne and Avery Johnson, are grossly overqualified for the jobs that they've been given, which they've been pulled off the frontline duty and put on this planet, on this harvest, in this remote place in order to train up some militia. But it's kind of, there's a bit of a subplot going on in terms of why are we here. Johnson didn't even request to be transferred, and his transfer request was authorized and he ended up here. Byrne is kind of weird, like, why would he be put here with Johnson after their big breakup that kind of happened at the start? And then you have Captain Ponder, who got demoted two positions to be put here. All of that kind of comes about because of another character who we haven't talked about, Julian Alcigny? How does the audiobook say that name?
Alcigny, but then again, they say Trebuchet, so we can take nothing for granted.
Yeah, Alcigny.
Alcigny, cool. She is the surprise only secret character in this book, and she orchestrates these three men being here because a ship has gone missing and they believed it was the insurrection stealing a ship, which is what they've started to do. And they talk about the tribute kind of like act of terrorism where a massive ship liner was blown up and it crashed into Reach. And this was kind of a big deal because, you know, the insurrection had never been so bold as to attack a planet like Reach. And they took a massive loss of life as a result. They kind of packed these two ships full of like bombs and just flew them into this cruise liner and caused lots of massive damage. So they were afraid that these ships were being stolen by the insurrection. But it turns out it was actually the Covenant, the first kind of ship that we kind of meet with the Covenant. And she gets these guys here to have like an investigation where they're here under the pretense that they're training the militia, which they are doing. But they're actually being brought here for this operation, essentially, to investigate and take out these insurrections, find out where this missing ship is going. And that mission quickly gets scrubbed when first contact happened. And I want to talk a little bit about that. The first contact that happens is awesome in terms of, like, it's also told really well. Julian just pretty much says, like, meets Johnson at a party and then reveals herself and why he's here. And there's, like, no messing with these guys. And she's like, you're here to do this specific job with me. No fucking messing around, go get ready or whatever. And then it cuts to a Kigar ship with some Ungoy on it. And we have, which is where we meet Dadab, who is one of the main like characters in this book. And he's really good. He's a deacon. So he's like a priest kind of chaplain. He's there for like the religious kind of like part of the ship, because the Kigar are not very religious. They're still pirate-like. They're portrayed really well here. There's a character who is Churrar, who is the ship captain of this ship. And it's interesting to think that this is what they're a missionary ship. That's the word I was looking for. And their job is to go out into the fringes of Covenant space and look for shit. Just see what they find. Find relics, find alien races, whatever. Which is, you think, is a terrible, but like, thing. Like, your first contact shouldn't be Kick Air, because they're, you know, not very nice.
But they're good at finding things. That's the thing. They're very motivated to find shit.
Their setup and their story, I didn't think we knew a whole lot of, and I found just the little bits we got interesting, and that's why I like Kigar. They're matriarchal, their piracy, their idea of their clans and like how they work. I find that all very fascinating. They essentially come onto a ship. They think it's got a relic because their Luminae says there's one here. It turns out that's just a major point we haven't touched on yet in the story, actually. So the Luminary is a device that the Covenant have, is a Forerunner device that pretty much says where Forerunner technology is. It shows you and where the glyph, where it is, everywhere in like the whole kind of space. It obviously has a limited range, but they bring these on these ships to search for things, like Forerunner relics. And it turns out that it is also identifies humans. It identifies humans as Reclaimer. And they're reading the glyph wrong, and they think it means reclamation, and they think it means relic. Because the Luminary shows Planet Harvest as having hundreds of thousands of quote-unquote relics, which are in fact humans. And this is a gross mistranslation, which pretty much leads to the main reason why the Covenant decided to wipe out. So we'll get into the hierarch story, and that's where that comes from. But anyway, long story short, the Kigar and their Luminary think there's a relic on a ship. They attack it, they breach into it, they cut in, they find it's all full of fruit. They're like, what the hell is this? And Dadab comes aboard the ship alongside a Hurgok called Lighter Than Some. This bromance of two wonderful characters kind of begins a little bit here, but they're on the ship, they're good friends. The Deacon kind of learns the sign language to talk to the Hurgok, which actually keeps the Deacon alive through a lot of this book. It's just his usefulness of being able to as a translator with Hurgok. And Lighter Than Some is a wonderful little engineer on this ship, keeping it alive. And Hurgok and the Deacon kind of play a game, and they play a game of like throwing rocks at different things. And he was using it to kill these kind of little cockroachy creatures. And Hurgok didn't like that because you're killing something. It had a sense of morality to it, which made it instantly one of the most interesting kind of Hurgok we've read about. And given the take that it's one of the oldest we've read about, it's kind of weird to think they haven't driven, because they've done multiple characters of Hurgoks, and everybody thinks of them like really badly and like really mistreats them. But they're just, because I think the way they're created and the way they kind of work, people think of them as tools as opposed to like a moral sentient being. And Lighter Than Some does like such a job in this, and it becomes a key character in terms of like what he does, sets up essentially the happy ending of the story. Do you know what I mean? Of like, he helps rebuild. And we'll probably talk about, geez, we're kind of pushing so much on, we should probably skip ahead, should we? I'm talking a lot here, guys.
Just before we jump on, can we take one moment to appreciate that the entire Covenant War started because of one faulty slipspace drive that dropped a freighter out prematurely?
Yeah, that's true, actually. I totally forgot about that.
The Kigar would never have discovered us if they hadn't have found this freighter and then backtracked. We were outside Covenant space. Harvest was outside Covenant space. Who knows how many years we would have gone before they would have stumbled upon us.
Exactly, if ever. I mean, we might have eventually branched out further and further, but even then, I think they make a point of saying Harvest is in the middle, is one of the furthest colonies from Earth that we've ever breached or reached.
Well, it was probably good for us in the long run, because the Covenant would have found the rings eventually.
That's actually interesting, yeah. What if a Covenant founds the ring without us even knowing about it and detonates it, and then we would have never known and eventually been wiped out? So the first contact, anyway, on this ship, the Kigar come onto this ship, they raid it, they kill the human captain. They don't realize the Hurgok kills it because it's attacking Doyab. They don't understand each other. This guy's the first time he's ever seen an alien. It's on his ship, and the ship captain is like, beating it with a fire hydrant. Doesn't sound like he's doing a whole lot of damage, but he's just like, holy crap, freaking out. The Hurgok throws a rock and kills this human without really realizing, essentially. But obviously, he's trying to protect his friend, the Deacon. That happens on, is it this ship?
That's the second ship.
This is the ship with the Jotuns.
Yeah.
That's right. There's Jotuns, which are like essentially machines. They're
just like farming equipment.
Yeah, they'll sound like combine harvesters and that. I imagine they're space John Deere's. That's how I picture them in my head. I feel sorry for this poor freighter captain because this poor bollocks has two ex-wives and a load of like alimony to pay and all this shit, and he just wanted to sail freight in his poor little ship and enjoy himself.
Yeah, he was so proud that like he does it like the noble way that he does it himself and not just some automated AI.
And he got killed by a jellyfish with a rock.
I think I got this ship mixed up with the one that they lay a trap. Burn and Avery lay a trap, and I think they take it so well when the Kigyar come into a third freighter and they think they're looking for relics and Burn and Avery are waiting for them. And I thought it was so well told how they set that kind of trap up and how like Avery was like, yeah, we have a problem. It is not insurrectionists taking our ships. It's aliens. And Jillian's like, what? And he's like, yeah, it's fucking aliens. And she's like, keep one of them alive. He's like, oh shit. So the guys eventually kick off and start fighting these Kigyar. I thought it was pretty cool fight because it's zero G. They had battle rifles, which were like at the time prototypes. He didn't really know how to use it properly. Zero G fighting wasn't doing a great job. I thought that was cool. That whole fight was really interesting. These needler knives that they have.
So cool.
And we've never seen them again, but they're just like needler blades that you stick in and they blow up inside a person. Burn gets stabbed with them. He takes it out and Johnson realizes it's going to blow up because it's flashing like a bomb. So he throws it into another Kigyar and he blows up. That first fight was kind of cool. Johnson, like Burn gets hurt. Johnson runs after the Kigyar captain. He runs back into their ship. He's like, what the fuck am I doing? And he kind of pretty much kills her. And she essentially starts blowing up her own ship by shooting her plasma pistol into the Ungai kind of his compartment, which is filled with methane so he can breathe. It pretty much blows up the ship. And then Burn essentially saves Johnson. And then that's essentially how they become friends. Or they reconcile their differences. Now, it's at this point I think we should probably talk about something else. Because we're over an hour and we haven't gotten very far.
Well, we've kind of jumped around a bit.
Do you want to talk about the... After the first contact, that's kind of like how they fight. And then you said they have a peaceful setup, which is kind of, that's a great scene. I thought it was really well done in terms of the first contact.
Yeah, to glance over some bits. I mean, you know, after this, like we said, DeKalb notifies High Charity. High Charity orders Brutes to come over to kind of assist and all that. And then we get more kind of Sing-Hilly backstory, learned, like we've kind of discussed already, about the origins of the Covenant and some of the histories of the other factions, like the Sangshayun and the Sangheili, and how they were very reverent and stuff like that, which then eventually led to that kind of garden scene where the two different races, the Jilhanae and the humans, kind of first meet, which then kind of goes awry. Then the Jilhanae is able to then retreat and kind of leave, and then they kind of regroup and... There's a lot of kind of confusion, I think, and kind of the interesting players here is that we meet Tartarus for the first time, but he's not like the big chiefdom that we see him in Halo 2. He's instead of a subordinate to his uncle, Maccabus, who is the chieftain of their pact and has the gravity hammer, the Fist of Ruk. It's kind of in this, we kind of get some more kind of diplomatic sort of like relations as to kind of what to do and talking with DeKalb and Lighter Than Some about all the reliquaries and the illuminations and all that before eventually an invasion kind of happens, right? To where they start glassing the planet or...
They don't start glassing, but they eventually start attacking. Like, at this point, the story shifts and goes to High Charity and we learn about the origins of the three hierarchs and the Minister for Fortitude, which I said, we have the Vice Minister of Tranquility. And I think then you have these philologist, which is essentially becomes Mercy.
I like how Mercy's literally just a hermit, a weird hermit that they're just like, ah, shit, you kind of witnessed something you shouldn't have. I guess you have to be part of our group now.
Yeah, their origin very quickly, and I'm going to see very quickly, I'm going to do this. They take the information from the Lurmnae. We've got a planet that's full of shit, full of relics. We're going to use this to manipulate our ways into power, and we want to make sure that the Oracle, because we have to go to the Oracle and make sure this is okay. So they go to the Oracle, which is under heavy guard.
Something, just quickly, something interesting is that the different Covenant ages, because right now they're in like, they just finished a war, so they're in the Age of Doubt, so they don't have a lot of direction. So finding this huge fortress full or planet full of Forerunner objects has kind of given, well, the future Hierarchs a reason to shift it into an Age of Reclamation, which means or is it the Age of Reclamation that they shift it to?
I think so, yeah.
And so when you shift an age, usually you either get a new Hierarch or you get all new Hierarchs. So you have to, like, go to the Oracle, get permission, and then you can kind of say, hey, I did this, let's shift it to the next age.
And the Oracle is on the Dreadnought, right? Or was from the Dreadnought. So is it Menedic
Bias? It's Menedic Bias, yeah. It's one of the shards.
They present the information to Mendigant, and they've basically said, like, they don't expect it to talk. It's been silent for so long. And then Mendigant basically gets sassy and goes, you're all so fucking stupid, and I've listened to you for so long. It's just like, you're all so dumb. You don't know what you're doing. This isn't reclamation. This is Reclaimer. I'm going to go and help out, like, the descendants of my people. And he tries to take off. He's like, I'm out of here, bitches.
He says, I'm going to go get them and bring them to the Ark, is what he says. So I think that's awesome. And he just tries to take the Dreadnought up. But because what the Sanctuary have been doing, which they've been getting the Legola worms, which eat Forerunner technology, and they put them into this Dreadnought. And then as they burrow and eat, they, like, take their excrement, I guess, and try and analyze it and learn.
They have tiny scanners in them. They've drilled holes in the hull. And they get them to swallow a sensor, and then they get them to wriggle through the inside of the Dreadnought.
And then they record and try to decipher different things, yeah.
They poop it out, so it's kind of cool.
It's kind of cool and disgusting at the same time, but it's alien as fuck, which is kind of cool. When Medica Bias try and takes off, and it would destroy High Charity, by the way, because they've built a city around this Dreadnought parked on this piece of a planet.
Which we see in Halo 2.
Yeah, and the Dreadnought short circuits. Because of all the Legola holes kind of burned into it, and that kind of kills Medicant Bias a little bit. He kind of shuts down. Because of the revelation that the three Sanshayum in this room with the Oracle are there to witness, and they realize that their religion is false, that they're mistaken, and that what they're built on is incorrect.
The big thing that they're worried about is, well, now these humans can take the power from us. The Sanshayum won't be at the top of the food chain anymore.
Yeah, if the humans are the descendants.
Yeah, they pretty much hatch a plan of, okay, we've got to murder and extinct these fools because they're not. We can't have this.
They're going to destabilize everything.
Exactly. So these three Hierarchs pretty much have their plan. There's a lot of bat working, and we're going to skip ahead. But that's essentially why, which is so important, of why humanity was never allowed into the Covenant, why they're being treated so differently. And if you cut back to Harvest, the Immaculus gets an order he doesn't like. Because he's a devout believer, he was told, ignore your luminary, it's wrong. These people are hiding the relics, they're to be exterminated, they're the worst kind of vermin, you must destroy them all.
Yeah, and destroy the planet, and destroying all these false relics, which he didn't like.
He can't get over that, so he decides to, they attack a town that has relics in it, that's on, like, on the outskirts of Harvest, so he's like, we'll go here, and he says, we're just going to attack this place. He drops down. He tries to, like, look for relics. He can't figure out why. All they do is see humans. It's kind of like, it's awesome. It's just such a great story and well told in that way. And I think we've covered so much and I've talked so much. I think we haven't talked about the AI yet.
Yeah, we haven't talked about the AI. I figured we'd bring that up. Well, like, so we have, so essentially one, when Maccabees comes down and they start fighting, I mean, there's a lot of skirmishes that go on, but then eventually it leads to them starting to glass.
Well, they're not glassing because it's a big thing and big important thing to know.
Do they not start glassing at all?
No, they're just plasma bombarding. They don't have that technology.
They don't have a key ship.
They have a they're brutes. They have the stupid ship.
I thought I read. I guess I misread somewhere where they said that, like, one of the characters was like watching Plasma like melt their village or something like that.
It's Plasma from a spaceship, so like it's blowing shit up, but it's not like the eventual beam, you know, glassing a planet.
They're just shooting houses one at a time as they like sail over the countryside.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, in any event, there, like, a secret council is kind of called to where the governor of Harvest, Governor Thune, gets Brian, Johnson, Ponder, and Jillian, and they all kind of get together to talk about what we're going to do next, and it eventually leads to Jillian shooting and killing Governor Thun.
And she doesn't kill him. She shoots him with the training rounds.
She uses the paint bullets that freeze you
up. I guess someone else should talk then.
They did paint it like that she was going to shoot and kill him.
I thought he died instantly, but then when she shot Ponder, he was actually in mortal danger, so then he left.
She didn't shoot Ponder. Ponder collapsed under his wounds.
Yeah, the TTR rounds are like a knockout, so they knock the governor out and she's like, make sure he stays unconscious until we're done. Is it probably worth talking about? Yeah, is it worth talking about Mac? Can I talk about Mac for a bit?
Oh my god, I love Mac and Sif. It's so good.
I was gonna kind of segue into the AIs at this point in the story of who Mac, Sif, and Loki are.
We've got Mac and Loki. So they are the original AI that came with the colony ship.
Now this colony is old. Loki came with the ship.
But Mac came with him as well. I thought Mac and Loki were a combined pair. This is how they operate.
They probably were, yeah. They switch between.
Because with the colony ship, they have Mac, which is like the day-to-day running of the colony. He's the agricultural part of the AI. And then they've got this Loki part that kind of hides in reserve. And he is like the planetary protection AI that no one knows about. If things hit the fan, he comes out.
Well, and also like, this duality keeps either from going into rampancy too much.
That's a huge interesting point in how that works. And they've never explored this again, except that we've talked a bunch of it. Like, even recently we've done Halsey's journal and stuff about the triad that she talks about of what an AI would be like, three of them working together as one. I thought it was really cool how they did two.
And an interesting point to make is I think the triad was the perfect team of AIs because none of them could go rampant. So I think the duality, they would eventually go rampant because there's just like a third, they need a third person to kind of take the weight off.
I think this is slightly different as well because it's not two AIs running in tandem. My grasp of it was whichever AI is active, the other one is like sent out into the equipment, like the combine harvesters and that, they're like put into stasis and left to recover.
Yeah, that's really what they said, yeah.
Mac is supposed to shut down when Loki takes over, but Mac like doesn't completely trust Loki, so we have this great bit in the later part of the novel, we'd talk about Sif, where Mac and Loki basically fight it out between the Mac gun and a couple of combine harvesters.
I didn't understand that at the time, but then afterwards I was like, oh, that's what was happening. It's really weirdly worded that it's actually these two AIs with different opinions kind of fighting each other for what they're going to do.
It's easier to follow in the audiobook, I think, than the written book, because the other AI that we haven't talked about is Sif, and she's the AI that runs the space elevator thing?
The Tiara, I think is how they call it.
That's what they describe it. It's basically seven space lifts, space elevators, because Harvest is such a productive planet that the gun that they originally had to shoot loads into orbit couldn't keep up with the production, so they have this massive space lift system, and she's installed as the AI to run it, because if you don't balance the loads on the seven strands, they snap, which happens to some poor bastards on one of the strands during the evacuation. One of the strands snaps and I think they said they lose like 20,000 people.
Yeah.
So they all get wasted. But Sif is this, she's like the, if Mac is the down-to-earth farmer, Sif is the stuck-up posh lady.
Yes.
She regrets it because she's basically messed up. She's like, pick this posh persona and then realize, no, these are farmers. And they prefer this like dusty, dirty, denim-clad AI that thinks he's a farmer instead of me.
Yeah, basically. And like her emotional algorithms are like super restrictive as well.
Max really sort of like friendly and sociable and gets on with everyone. And she's like, he's a bit rampant. I don't like him. But then as things go on, she does. And then you find out that Mac made a deal with Loki that Loki would look after Sif. But instead, Loki murdered her and decided she was too much of a risk.
Oh man, they made that so brutal. I thought how he murdered her was just like horrifying. I was like, holy shit, AI versus AI can be some fucked up stuff. And I thought it was really well done.
She doesn't know yet, so he like transmits a fragment up and she goes to tug him and then realizes it's not Mac anymore and then puts two and two together just in time to like be gutted because she can't stand up to a military AI like him, and it is really sad. But he leaves a little fragment of her, which thankfully the engineer repairs later on. So that's how they basically save this, because Loki and Mac are fighting on the surface, and Loki has strict instructions to take out the tiara so that the Covenant can't like raid the servers later. Mac won't let him, so they have to have this sad, like, Loki won't let Mac and Sif talk, so they have to like pass messages back and forth between each other. There was like a bit of a brutal put down earlier in the story where Mac is sleazing around Sif and he misquotes
Shakespeare,
and she's all like stuck up about it and sends him all the works of Shakespeare, and then Mac reveals, no, I'm actually educated and I know what I was talking about. So she uses like another quote from Shakespeare to like tell Mac that everything's all right and that he can let Loki shoot her, and then she has 5 seconds left to like be happy with her lot in life before she gets taken out.
And she like realizes she loves him, and oh, it's really sad. And then like at the very end of the book, you get kind of Mac just like sending messages to Sif, but Sif isn't there to like receive them, but he just keeps sending like all these Shakespeare quotes. Oh my god.
As he buries her, what the remains of her installation on Harvest, like he's burying, like, because that whole structure obviously crashes down after it gets shot the fuck with the mass driver. Oh man, it was, what an ending. And that's like the epilogue, is actually Halsey looking at this. And I didn't catch that. I had to look up that in a piece of trivia. So let me actually just read that, because that's like the final. That's how the book ends even, is that moment where, so the novel ends with Dr. Catherine Halsey accessing the data archives of Gillian's sloop and reviewing the final conversations of Mac's attempts to hold with Sif as his rampancy sets in, and as his, as the Jotuns are slowly getting destroyed by the Covenant that have come back to Harvest.
Do you have the 2019 version?
No, I maybe. Is that not an original? Because this is the ebook I bought the other day.
It's not in the audiobook.
It's not in the audiobook, but it's...
Is it not?
I think it's in the regular edition, though. It's kind of hard to read if it's in the audiobook, just because of the way the text is laid out.
Essentially, it is Mac having a conversation with himself, but he's sending these messages to Sif, who doesn't exist anymore. And he only exists in the Jotuns. And they're slowly getting wiped out and breaking down, because obviously there's no humans there, they're not being repaired, the Covenant are still on the planet, slowly taking it over and fighting and stuff like that. And he's just losing Jotuns, and as he loses Jotuns, he's losing processing power, he's not making sense, obviously he's going more and more rampant, and all he's doing is using the Jotuns to kind of bury the remains of the tiara, as he kind of has quotes and talks about, you know, sending her things about, like, Shakespeare and everything. Oh, it's hard, it's sad, do you know what I mean? But it's, I think it's interesting that it's Halsey accessing this file and to study it.
In the one I read, like, Halsey isn't really mentioned at all. It's just kind of the transmission. You're just reading the transmission log.
It's not mentioned as Halsey. It's actually said, if you look at who's accessing that log, it's a civilian contractor with a number called Charlie Hotel.
And
that's actually Halsey's call sign. That's her.
Well, it's a great, like, study material for Halsey, who's like a big AI person.
Yeah, I think I vaguely remember that, and then I was like listening to the audiobook going like, why don't I remember this bit at the end, or did I imagine it, or where did that come from?
It's a nice, I say nice, it's a sad kind of end to it.
Something we didn't cover that you don't appreciate if you get the book version is they have Jen Taylor narrate all of Sif's parts in the audiobook.
That's nice.
They actually, yeah, they have two narrators for the audiobook. So they've got Holder Graham, who does all the Mac stuff and the general stuff. But then Jen Taylor does all of Sif's stuff.
Does she do it differently? So it's not Cortana? Would there be a difference?
She's a very just, I think she sounds kind of like Jen Taylor doing Jen Taylor, not doing Cortana.
Yeah, it's like, because Cortana has a certain like inflection to how does she talk, whereas like Sif is just kind of Halsey just talking in a very monotonous, just regular tone.
So before I do the last bit of trivia and close it out, this is obviously way longer than we expected, but I'm pretty happy because it's so much to talk about and it's a really great book. So do you guys have anything else you'd like to touch on?
I really like Lighter Than Some. He's like my favorite Hurragok character.
We didn't spend a lot of time on him, but I don't think we need to.
Basically, he regrets killing a human and he wants peace with the humans and doesn't want all this like genocide happening. And so his whole character arc is him trying to make peace with the humans.
So he builds and creates choppers. So brute choppers come from him.
Yeah, they're supposed to be plows.
They're supposed to be plows, anti-grav plows, which is hilarious. And then they get turned into brute choppers. And then he rebuilds Sif and brings her back. That allows Loki to actually correctly rebalance the tiara as, like, as I said, we lose a strand and 20,000 people are just shot off into space. Do you know what I mean? And then Sif helps Mac kind of counterbalance and, like, keep it alive for everyone else to shoot up these strands.
Also, he gets shredded by buggers and it's just disgusting.
That's horrible.
They don't like Lighter Than Some because he took their job. And so they shred him at the end.
Because they take out Lighter Than Some, Dadaab goes on a vengeance quest against Tartarus, and poor Dadaab gets squished.
Yeah, he gets hit by the gravity hammer.
He just decides, and that's such a good moment.
He brings his shields down, though.
Is this a gravity hammer, or is this just an ordinary stone hammer?
No, it's the Halo 2 hammer.
It is that hammer. They described it. It's the Fist of Rukt, which is the hammer in Halo 2, but it is described here as a big piece of fucking stone.
I don't think it's yet a gravity hammer. I don't think they have it because it just describes Dadaab disappearing between his arms and legs, like his torso just crushes to the floor.
Well, if you think about it, like Ponder gets hit by it. He doesn't, he has a prosthetic arm which gets kind of wrecked and a couple of his ribs and stuff get broken. He gets kind of pretty badly hurt. If that was a gravity hammer, he'd be dead.
Truth must have given him the enhancements to put on the Fist of Rukt.
I'm guessing that's what he did. Like, obviously it's 20 years between now and Halo 2. So like, I'm guessing, yeah, it gets modified along the way as he gets more status within the Covenant.
Maccabeus does say that they're not even allowed an anti-grav lift in the ship. So probably a gravity hammer would have been something Truth could only give them down the line.
That was also really interesting as well. Obviously, there's a lot of racism within the Covenant, and the Sangheili do not trust, and they were correct, do not trust the Jangheili and their brutish ways. So, like, when they give them a ship, Maccabeus is one of the first and only, at the time, brutes to have a ship, and they strip it the fuck down. It is a piece of crap that he is given. All his the major weapons are disabled. There's no internal lifts. There's no gravity tech. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't have a Hurragok. He has to use the buggers as like to maintain the ship, and they're rubbish at it. And you know, the Jor-El-Hani are also rubbish at it.
The thing that really makes me like Maccabeus in this, though, is his little story about how he gets his own back on the elites.
Oh, that's really good.
They give him a mechanical lift, and he goes, "Now fuck this." He puts ladders in. And then the elites are the only members of the Covenant whose knees go the wrong way, so they have a really hard time climbing ladders. He's being really sarcastic, being like, "Oh, I thought the lift was too far beyond us, so I took it out." And the elites go, "What?" And then he's like, "Come on, let's explore the ship, up the ladders." And then by the end of it, the elites are exhausted, and he's like, "I've won a victory here."
I like him a lot. He's a great character. It really kind of highlights how indoctrinated some of the brutes were some of the brute clans were, because he is super religious. He's really religious.
And Tartarus is not, but we knew that anyway.
Well, Tartarus is as well. Like, he kind of really believes in it too, but I think Tartarus believes more in truth than anything else, whereas Maccabeus believed in the religion.
I think Tartarus believes in the power that comes with believing.
Yeah, I think that's part of it too. Because even in Halo 2, you can see how he mistreats 343. Do you know what I mean? He's like, it's an oracle. And the Arbiter says, like, oh, is it? Like, he doesn't give a shit. Oren, do you have anything else to add before I kind of wrap this baby up?
I really enjoyed reading it. It had a lot of information in there, some that I already knew, but it kind of gave a great perspective on to kind of see how it was written back in like 2007. And I think it's a very interesting note that it was supposed to come out before Halo 3 launched, which I think would have definitely enhanced the playing experience back then, especially with like getting close to Johnson, but also just like better understanding the foundations of the Covenant as the Great Schism happened. Because like when Halo Wars 2 Anniversary came out with the Master Chief Collection, that launch in 2014 was kind of paired with Broken Circle, which gave a lot of perspective about the foundation and a little bit more of a story as opposed to like a history retelling. And so I feel like this definitely gave a lot of reinforcement to the Halo 3 story, just like Broken Circle kind of gave to Halo Wars 2 or just Halo 2. But yeah, I think it's definitely on the must-read list if you were to only read a couple of the books. And I'm very much enjoyed reading through it.
There's a few bits of trivia I might just say, and then we'll get the hell out of here. Hopefully you guys stayed till the end of the show, because it's a long one.
It definitely did. True listeners.
Okay, true listeners. Cow Death Harvest is Dayton's first published novel, which we said, but it actually only came about because Tor Books came to 343, or came to Bungie and Microsoft and said, do another Halo book. That's how this book came about. The Marathon symbol appears between the A and L of Halo in the cover's logo. I never noticed, but there you go. It is the first Halo novel to not feature a Spartan 2.
Oh, yeah.
That is interesting, so there you go. At the beginning of Chapter 5, the date is incorrectly labeled as December 21st, 2525, instead of December 21st, 2524. This is interesting, and I would throw it in here. It may be possible that Johnson and Jillian are married, as Johnson will occasionally make remarks in the games about his supposed mother-in-law, especially during Halo 2. Whether it was just Johnson's typical sense of humor or actually a meaningful in any way is unknown. So I thought I'd just leave that in there.
That is interesting.
Or it could be just him making a joke about mother-in-laws in general, not actually having one. Just thought that was cool. That there's a possible thread in there to be picked up.
Johnson Jr.
Oh, God.
I hope not.
I'm here to avenge my dad.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this very long. What is it? Very long. What are we on? We got an hour and...
I mean, we had some banter. I bet you it'll be about an hour 15.
Yeah, okay. We'll see if we get on. That's okay. Like I said, you can find all of our shows on our website, halopodcast12.com. It also has links to our Discord server, Facebook. There's merch on there. There's a shop, there's store, there's stuff, there's everything. If you would like to, you can also leave us a voicemail or anything Halo related, really, if you like, and give us a call at 205-EVOLVED. That's 205-386-5833, which is a crazy American number, so it doesn't make sense to me. And with that, I have been your host, David, and until next time, evolved.
Evolved.